The assets of Ayatollah Khomeini and his office will not be spared from the sanctions.
Well, that'll show Ayatollah Khomeini, who died in 1989.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, in Cottage Grove on KSO, and in Eugene on KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Up in Grand Rapids on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, in Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, just to name a few of our many fine affiliates. Coast to coast and around the globe, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Well, it seems like here we go again. It seems like deja vu all over again to some extent. It feels like Donald Trump's blusterous threats of fire and fury against North Korea feels like that all over again, except this time it's Iran. And whether it'll work out as well as Trump's chest thumping against Kim Jong-un did back when Kim pretended to agree to a deal with Trump when no deal was actually made, so that he was allowed to continue building his nuclear program while Trump was invested in claiming that North Korea no longer posed a threat due to his great deal-making progress. Well, I don't know if things will turn out that well as they did in North Korea in Iran. But I sure as hell hope that it does. Fresh sanctions were levied by the U.S. against Iran on Tuesday. They drew intense reactions from the Islamic Republic, with one senior official saying the sanctions spell the quote, permanent closure of diplomacy between the two countries. Iran said it would take new steps to reduce its commitments under its nuclear deal with world powers as of July 7. According to Iran's semi-official news agency, Fars, the head of Iran's National Security Council said European signatories to the nuclear deal had not done enough to save it after Trump unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the deal. The landmark 2015 agreement requires Iran to curb its nuclear program in exchange for lifting of sanctions that have been in place for decades against the country. Iran complied with the deal by the measure of everyone, including the U.S., but we, the U.S., broke the deal when Donald Trump declared that he was pulling out and restoring crippling sanctions against them last year. And again on Monday, this time against Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and his associates. That, of course, is different than Ayatollah Khomeini, who you heard Trump there at the top of the program saying that he was going to be sanctioning, even though Ayatollah Khomeini died in 1989.
Yeah.
Which is something you think you might know, but, you know, details.
Yeah.
Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hello.
The measures deny Khamenei and senior Iranian military figures access to financial resources and block their assets to any access to any assets that they may have under U.S. jurisdiction. In other words, it freezes their accounts, just the way the nuclear deal that was struck in 2015 under Barack Obama finally unfreezed many of those accounts. And that's why Iran received billions of dollars. It was not a gift from the U.S. to them. It was allowing them to have their own money back that had been frozen since the Islamic Revolution back there in the 80s, 79, I think it was. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani mocked Donald Trump, calling the measures, quote, outrageous and idiotic, and saying the White House is suffering from a, quote, mental illness. Of course, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is correct, and it is shameful that Democrats, who are not suffering from mental illness that I know of, so they have no excuse, it's shameful that they have been unwilling or unable to do anything about this White House, which is suffering from a mental illness. Rouhani said, "You call for negotiations. If you are telling the truth, why are you simultaneously seeking to sanction our foreign minister?" Trump fired back later Tuesday against the remarks from the Iranian president, warning that any attack by Iran, quote, will be met with great and overwhelming force. What, no fire and fury? The U.S. measures were, in part, a response to Iran shooting down a U.S. surveillance drone that it said had entered its airspace. The U.S. says it was flying in international airspace. Rouhani said in a televised speech on Tuesday that Trump's latest sanctions were, quote, hilarious, end quote, a stupid and ugly act. Rouhani said the incident, quote, raised the nation's confidence and showed, quote, we are not scared of the U.S., but we do have strategic patience. U.S. officials also said they planned sanctions against Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, who worked closely with then Secretary of State John Kerry during negotiations for the landmark nuclear deal that Trump withdrew from. But it's by its conclusions, NBC notes, Kerry and Zarif were on first-name terms, with the Secretary of State hailing his counterpart as a patriot who enjoyed his mutual respect. Washington Post reports that Iranian officials also lashed out at Trump for its, quote, useless sanctioning of Zarif and the head of Iran's nuclear negotiations, a spokesperson for the foreign ministry said, according to the Post. So we are sanctioning all of the people with whom Donald Trump pretends or claims that he wants to be negotiating with. With tensions high now, U.S. officials such as John Bolton, the national security advisor, say they want to enter into negotiations with Iran. Quote, all that Iran needs to do is walk through that open door, Bolton told a high-profile security summit in Jerusalem. Yes, that's the same John Bolton who has called for war and regime change in Iran. So why would they ever, ever want to walk through such a door to speak with him? And especially now that sanctions have been slapped on the very negotiators who would be walking through that door. Who actually thinks that this is how international diplomacy works? Well, I guess Donald Trump. And, you know, given his comments today, he was asked at the White House, Desi, was this in the Oval Office today?
Yes, this was in a press scrum in the Oval Office.
So that if war should break out with Iran, the reporter wanted to know, does Donald Trump have an exit strategy for that?
Do you have an exit strategy for Iran if war does break out?
You're not going to need an exit strategy. I don't need exit strategies.
He doesn't need exit strategies.
Yeah. If you have an active duty family member right now in the U.S. military, that is those are chilling words to hear.
Well, now, yes, they are. On the other hand, maybe he needs no exit strategy because he's a coward and he's actually not going to go to war with Iran. He's full of bluster and he knows he's not going to go to war with Iran. Of course, that presumes there's not another, we'll call it accident of some type, like that drone that was shot down. But, you know, so, yeah, international diplomacy does not work this way. War does not work this way. You know, but especially when we're dealing with a partner with whom detente was actually found finally after decades of absolutely no diplomatic contact whatsoever during the Obama administration, to now turn around, slap sanctions, break the deal that was working, slap sanctions on the negotiators, and then wonder, well, gosh, I wonder why they're not walking through this door.
Gosh, I wonder why they don't trust the United States to keep any deal that it might make.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Abbas Mousavi responded to the sanctions, adding to other measures already squeezing his country's economy. He said that that makes negotiations impossible under the current circumstances. He says the sanctions mean, quote, the permanent closure of the path of diplomacy with the desperate government of the United States. Mousavi's statement echoed that of Iran's UN ambassador, who warned Monday that the situation in the Persian Gulf is, quote, very dangerous, and said any talks with the U.S. are impossible in the face of escalating sanctions and intimidation. For its part, Russia says it is concerned about the rising tensions. On Tuesday, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called the new U.S. sanctions, quote, a very bad scenario. He likened Washington's actions to its justification in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003. Well, he said, we all remember how that ended. And I'm hoping that that reminder from Russia, who Trump respects, that reminder about the Iraq War, which Trump belatedly decided that he did not support after initially saying that he did, you know, until it went badly. And then he said, oh, I was against it the whole time. I'm hoping that that warning from Russia might keep Trump from trying to prove how he is not the coward that we all actually know him to be. At this point, I think his cowardice may be the only thing keeping us out of World War III. So I'm good with it. Washington says the measures were taken to discourage Tehran from developing nuclear weapons and supporting militant groups. Well, you know what had kept them from developing nuclear weapons? That would be the 2015 seven-nation landmark Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, agreement that was working to prevent them from developing nuclear actions, working by all measures until Trump scuttled it. Now, of course, with no agreement in place, since Trump broke the deal, Iran is, by and large, free to do whatever they want. Good job, Donald. Iran was, in fact, abiding by the deal, which eased sanctions in exchange for curbing their nuclear program. Its other signatories to the deal have stuck with it, but Trump withdrew, saying its terms were just too soft. In protest at the U.S. walking away, Iran said that later this week it will breach the uranium limit that it had agreed to with world powers 4 years ago. Even though the U.S. has withdrawn from that agreement, it says it still expects Iran to abide by its terms. And Bolton said Tuesday that, quote, all options remain on the table if Iran reneges. All options remain on the table if Iran reneges from a deal that we already reneged from? Yes, that's what John Bolton actually said. So while John Bolton can't understand why they aren't, you know, walking through, I wonder why they're not walking through that open door to negotiate with him. I mean, are these guys, the Trump guys, just the dumbest goddamn people who have ever been in charge of our nation or what?
Yes.
Yes,
sorry.
I agree.
Yes. Yes, they are.
I mean, the question kind of answers itself, but you have answered it correctly, Desi Doyen.
Thank you.
But in addition to being stupid, they're also damn dangerous. So that's really the concern right now. And all of this is just one more reason why this man needs to be removed from office, be it by impeachment or at the ballot box next year, neither of which can happen soon enough as far as I'm concerned. Not that the folks whose brains have been poisoned by Fox News, however, even have a clue of what is actually going on. They actually think that the Iran deal was a ripoff, and they're delighted that Donald Trump got out of it so that he can stop their nuclear program, which was stopped by the deal. Anyway, yeah, it's not just me speaking about the brain poisoned folks over at Fox News. It's also Fox News's campaign Carl Cameron, who was, until he finally retired from the phony news channel a year or two ago, until then he was one of its most beloved reporters, Carl Cameron, who had been there from the start of that fake news outlet. Even Cameron himself, as of yesterday, is now calling out Fox News as a fake news outlet that now delivers little more than blatant partisan misinformation to its gullible viewers. Here's Cameron.
Hey, do you know me? Do you think you know me? I'm Carl Cameron, and some know me as Campaign Carl, the guy on Fox News who covered elections and presidential campaigns since, like, forever. What's a former Fox guy doing here on Front Page Live partnering with progressives? Well, it's about facts, not partisanship. I was one of Fox's first hires. The idea of fair and balanced news appealed to me. But over the years, right-wing hosts drowned out straight journalism with partisan misinformation. I left. I have unique insight and understanding of how the right operates and literally 30 years of covering Donald Trump. Trump's a con man. He did collude and coordinate with Russia to get elected.
Wow.
He encouraged them to intervene in the 2016 campaign on live television. We all saw it. And recently he said he'd accept their help again because he sees nothing wrong with it. We saw that too. And yes, he is still helping Russia by refusing to take strong actions to protect us from a future cyber attack. This is a state of emergency. Our next elections and democracy are at potential risk. My job, what I do, is inform. That's it. Make your own decisions. Just please be accurately informed.
There was Campaign Carl Cameron in what is an ad. The rest of the video goes on to hype Cameron's new venture, which he's doing apparently along with our friend Joe Rome from Climate Progress. They're creating what they describe as a progressive answer to the Drudge Report. The new website is called frontpagelive.com, and Cameron serves as the chief political correspondent, apparently. He's not the only former Fox personality, of course, to call out the network's opinion hosts in particular after leaving. Last year, retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, you may recall, a former longtime Fox contributor, he criticized the network in an op-ed for the Washington Post, citing the network's propagandizing for Donald Trump and charging that, quote, today's Fox primetime lineup preaches paranoia, attacking processes and institutions vital to our republic and challenging the rule of law. In his resignation letter to Fox, he called the network, quote, a propaganda machine for a destructive and ethically ruinous administration.
Wow.
Nailed it. Yeah. Now, with all of that said, which doesn't even deal with the fact that the 22nd woman to come forward to accuse Donald Trump of sexual assault last week, a well-known magazine columnist who's offered credible details that Donald Trump raped her some decades ago. With all of that, removing this dangerous, demented clown at the ballot box ought to be the easiest thing in the world for Democrats to do next year. At least it should be if we had a level playing field, but we don't. Instead, we have things like Fox News and the right-wing media, which is willing to do anything to gaslight the American people, including, by the way, the New York Post, which is owned just like Fox News by Rupert Murdoch. They went so far as to actually pull the story, remove the story from their website about E. Jean Carroll's rape allegations against Trump, pulled it off the website entirely. I'm actually surprised it got up there at all in the first place. And, you know, as we discuss quite frequently, we have election systems across the country which are wildly vulnerable to manipulation and only becoming more so in advance of 2020. Legislation requiring hand-marked paper ballots, which can be known to reflect the voter intent, was passed in the U.S. House, but Mitch McConnell will now not allow any election security measures through the U.S. Senate, like Ron Wyden's PAVE Act that also requires hand-marked paper ballots to be brought up for a vote in the Senate. Well, today, 2020 presidential election candidate Elizabeth Warren released her own plan for election reform. It was published in an article in Medium. She notes that we need a constitutional amendment to guarantee the right to vote. It's true, we don't have one, believe it or not. But she says the moral necessity of this amendment should not stop us from acting now. Her plan would have the federal government replace every, quote, insecure and outdated voting system in the nation with, quote, hand-marked, voter-verified paper ballots. Well, thank you, Senator. We concur. There's much more that she calls for, uniform ballots, automatic voter registration, same-day registration, ending gerrymandering, all sorts of things in her plan that I will link you to. She is just the latest presidential contender to take a stand on this issue. Recently, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, she also posted to Medium and referenced in her article that if elected, she would, quote, prioritize cybersecurity and protect our elections and other American infrastructure from cyber attack. She said she would introduce legislation that funded election security efforts requiring, quote, backup paper ballots.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
Sorry about that, Senator. This is 2019. She should know by now that we don't need backup paper ballots. We need hand-marked paper ballots, period, in front, not in the back. And Senator, your colleague, Senator Wyden, he's calling for that in the PAVE Act. Elizabeth Warren called for it today. Paper backup sounds much like the computer-marked touchscreen systems that are being pushed by the vendors around the country and coming to jurisdictions such as L.A. County in time for Super Tuesday next year on March 3, as we discussed on yesterday's broadcast, which you can download for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who support our work at bradblog.com/donate. Yesterday, I cited even the former counsel for the North Carolina Board of Elections. North Carolina! Josh Lawson, with all of the election problems in that state that I don't even have time to list quickly today, Lawson was saying that, yes, we all need hand-marked paper ballots for all voters.
Well, I'm a private citizen now, so I get to say whatever I think. I absolutely think that the way that two-thirds of the state already votes, which is paper ballots that are hand-marked, that's the way to go.
So, thank you, Josh. In that same interview with Spectrum TV, the host Tim Boyum also asked Lawson about the horrific idea of internet voting.
Technology is moving everything in our lives right now, and we're doing more and more with technology. But in some ways, what I think you're saying, what I hear others say, is we need to stay with that old-fashioned filling out a paper ballot because that is as a paper trail. But there are others that think we want to do online voting to make it a lot easier. Can we ever get to online voting, or do we always need to do it on this because of the hacking concerns?
Well, I was with the Board of Elections for 5 years, and before going to the Board of Elections, I thought, absolutely, we're headed towards some kind of multi-tiered encryption scheme where we're going to be able to accommodate just that type of process. The more I've seen it, the more I've been involved in that process, I believe that voting, things this sensitive, need a transition back to analog. And I'm joined in that by all of the research that's being done in this field post-2012 and then 2016. It's really important that we understand the vulnerabilities that exist with digital systems, particularly ones that are connected to the internet in an unregulated space like elections. I think that that's where we need to be headed.
Now, Lawson is right there, of course. That's not particularly controversial. Internet voting is a terrible idea. But really, someone ought to tell the Democratic National Committee, who, as we discussed on this program a few months ago, has now mandated that states which hold Democratic caucuses instead of primaries in 2020 must add some form of remote voting, like, for example, internet voting to their caucuses. Really? Yeah, really. We spoke to Steve Rosenfeld of Voting Booth about it at the time a few months ago, as those early caucus states like Iowa and Nevada were scrambling to try and come up with some kind of scheme to meet the DNC mandate, looking at proposals from all sorts of private companies who would love to help the Democrats out with internet voting, no matter how unsecure and unoverseeable such systems are. Well, we have some maybe good news on that front today. Steve Rosenfeld joins us once again for the story. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Following the 2016 presidential election and a host of complaints about its nominating process, the Democratic National Committee took some time to restructure that process to answer to many of those complaints. Among the things they rethunk were the process for holding debates, which, as we will see in a day or two here, has resulted in some 20 candidates participating in two-night debates with candidate eligibility determined not only by polling numbers, but also by a measure of grassroots support via small donations from around the country. There's also going to be a lot of these debates. As many as 12 Democratic primary debates are currently envisioned. But another element of the party's restructuring concerns how caucuses are held, with many complaining after 2016 that caucuses are less egalitarian than actual statewide primaries, since many are unable to attend caucuses in person, and that they tend to reward candidates with the most ardent supporters, if not the candidates with the most supporters in any given state. In addition to encouraging many states who have held caucuses in the past to hold primary elections instead in 2020, the DNC has mandated that those states which do decide to continue their tradition of caucusing instead of holding primary votes add a form of remote voting, so that people who may not be able to attend may still be able to participate in some fashion. Stephen Rosenfeld has been covering this little reported new provision for Democratic caucuses, which, for those of us paying attention, presents some very disturbing ramifications. In states such as Iowa and Nevada, both early caucus states, state Democratic parties still plan on running caucuses, but with the new DNC mandate, they are still in the process of figuring out how the hell to add a remote voting option, including the use of phone voting and, gulp, yes, internet voting, perhaps the most dangerous and unverifiable method for voting imaginable. We spoke with Rosenfeld on the broadcast a few months ago about this disturbing, ill-considered, and frankly insane idea that seems to just be begging for trouble and controversy right at the official kickoff of the Democratic nominating process, when Iowa caucuses the first week in February and Nevada follows closely thereafter on the third week in February. The very trouble and controversy that I'm fairly certain that the DNC believed they were hoping to avoid by mandating these new provisions for caucuses. Cauci? In the first place, while this entire matter has received very little coverage today, other than from Rosenfeld for the most part, Stephen recently filed a report in an article for the Independent Media Institute's Voting Booth Project that was published by Common Dreams, reporting that the party is now having second thoughts about the use of remote phone and or online voting for the 2020 caucuses. Well, that's good news. He writes, the Democratic National Committee may reverse course on its plans to increase participation in 2020 presidential caucuses by offering off-site voting options, starting with telephone voting in Iowa and possibly online voting in other states. That prospect of a reversal, at least in the early nominating caucuses, stems from growing concerns in top party circles about protecting the integrity of the process in a post-2016 climate. That, according to James Roosevelt III, co-chair of the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee. It is entirely possible, said Roosevelt, the committee is going to be looking to be convinced that this will work. I think the committee is subject to competing pressures. One is to honor Iowa's commitment to participatory democracy, and the other is to a heightened sensitivity that did not exist 4 or certainly 8 years ago to the integrity of the process. Well, that heightened sensitivity may not have existed to the integrity of the process at the DNC, where they've long been putting their heads in the sand regarding the vulnerability of computerized voting and tabulation systems, not to mention remote online voting, internet voting, all of which we have been warning about here on the broadcast and at bradblog.com for, I don't know, just about 15 years or so. But it's nice to see that Democrats are finally beginning to catch up, finally beginning to become a little bit concerned about it. Joining us now for an update on this mess with what appears to be some moderately encouraging news today that the Democrats are rethinking their latest terrible idea, at least when it comes to the use of internet voting, is Stephen Rosenfeld. He's a reporter and writing fellow at Voting Booth, a project of the Independent Media Institute, where he focuses on how and if technology can make voting more transparent and trustworthy. It can't. Just FYI, though Steve may disagree. He's also written 5 books, among those books, Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting, and his latest, Democracy Betrayed, How Superdelegates, Redistricting, Party Insiders, and the Electoral College Rigged the 2016 Election. Steve Rosenfeld, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Yeah, hi. Nice to be here.
Steve, first, what is the general complaint about caucuses? And is there a merit to those complaints as you see it?
Well, caucuses are, they're like town meetings mm-hmm. that originated in New England. Mm-hmm. And I've been to many. And the problem with caucuses from a presidential nominating standpoint, as opposed to approving, you know, the school budget and the you know, town budget in mm-hmm. a small town in Vermont, where I saw a zillion of them, is that they tend to be run by local folks who are just ordinary folks. That's very, you know, grassrootsy. That's really cool. But the thing is, these are not, you know, elections for school board presidents mm-hmm. or high school principals or the. They are, you know, they have presidential stakes, and they generally are not as professionally run in a manner that reflects what's, you know, the stakes of mm-hmm. what's going on at hand. And you can get into all kinds of examples of how people are pushy or campaigns are pushy and they don't register or they storm past mm-hmm. the doors, and then they're generally, they are not run by election officials.
Well, it seems to me then that the corrective measure here to those complaints is to basically mandate primaries that are run by election officials.
Yeah, this was a big debate coming out of 2018, mm-hmm. and a lot of people in the party wanted to basically phase out caucuses.
Right.
But and the woman who was actually, you know, running Beto's campaign, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, she was on the, you know, this Unity Reform Commission as the co-chair.
Yeah.
The last minute they pushed back, you know, states like Iowa. And, you know, all political vanities are local, and in places like Iowa and others, they wanted to continue what they were doing, which was to have, you know, this political industry based on a very privileged position. So the thing about caucuses is this. These are not government-run elections.
Right.
So this is really, really, really critical, because this means that all of the cybersecurity efforts, of which there have been tremendous efforts made since 2016 to deal with, you know, trying to tighten systems, those have all been in government election systems.
Right.
These are private elections. What the state parties will do in the caucus states is they have to rent a voting system.
Right.
These do not have to be certified voting systems that you need to use certified voting systems.
Well, to be clear, let me jump in here, Steve. To be clear, in states like Iowa, where they have the caucuses, I don't believe they rent any systems at all.
No, but we're talking about for the remote part of this thing. Yeah, the caucuses are privately run.
Right.
They don't release raw vote totals. They don't release raw numbers. They have never been transparent. They will announce, you know, who gets some percentage of the delegates to the next stage of the process. And there's a history in different states. I mean, you know, it was a virtual tie between Bernie and Hillary in 2016 in Iowa. In 2012, one precinct or two precincts on the Republican side didn't turn in the results in time. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that Mitt Romney was not the winner, even though he got the headlines. It was Rick Santorum. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is, you have this, they're basically privately run, but when you talk about introducing, as the DNC wants to introduce, a remote voting element, they have to rent the voting system mm-hmm. to do this. And it's not just one system.
Right.
It has elements of it. You have to do registration, you have to do balloting, you have to do tabulating, and it all has to go right and go well. And the listen, I don't want elections anywhere to fail. I would like them to be trustworthy and transparent. But what I have done is I have tried to look and see where these kinds of systems have been used elsewhere. And they've been used in some Republican Party caucuses. You know, in Utah, they've been used widely mm-hmm. in Canada in municipal elections. And the bottom line is, apart from the cybersecurity scenarios, which is, you know, I don't think there is a bigger, easy target if somebody wants to mess with something. Because, again, Brad, I asked Jim Roosevelt, do you know if the state parties are even talking to the Department of Homeland Security, which is doing all the federal cybersecurity stuff? And he said, we will be asking that question.
Well, hang on. Let me get to that then, because, I need to respond to a couple of points you made. One, in fact, and I really want to look forward, not back here, not to sound like Barack Obama, but in fact, that the GOP caucus you were talking about from Iowa a few years ago, it actually was the transparency that helped us determine. It was hand-counted paper ballots at the caucus site with photographs made by the voters who were there, the caucusers who were there, that helped us discover that, in fact, you're right, Rick Santorum actually won Iowa, not Mitt Romney. It was an error in the tabulation at the headquarters, at the GOP headquarters, but they had the documentation from the caucus site showing that, in fact, you know, Romney had received 2 votes instead of 22 votes at that particular caucus. We had the guy on the show many years ago who actually, had that photograph and proved that case. But looking forward, it feels like we've got some good news here for those of us who think that internet voting is insane and 100% unverifiable at any time, not just in this time of heightened sensitivity following the 2016 election, as that party man Roosevelt had said. So you've got a detailed report on this at Common Dreams. Why are members of the DNC Rules Committee finally now, in what seems to be good news, why are they having second thoughts about the remote voting option?
Well, I think that they're hearing from different people that this is really more complicated than they expected. What you have is, going back, is Tom Perez, the DNC chair, wants to increase participation.
Right.
He wants to increase participation among 2 particular groups, in these caucuses. Now, these are, which is, older folks who might be homebound, and younger folks who are cannot put down their their devices, and think that going to some town meeting like thing is kind of old fashioned,
right,
and who knows what. So what they decided to do was they decided to add this virtual voting, remote voting requirement.
Mm-hmm.
They published the 2020 delegate selection rules in December,
right,
and what it. And now, so just here's the process. Just follow this.
Well, okay, I want to point folks towards your article for that and our last discussion on this, because I'm a little short on time, and I want to make sure that we get to what doing now.
Well, I'll be quick.
Yeah.
I'll be really quick.
Okay, go ahead.
So here's the process. The states then create these plans, these goals. They then have to figure out how to get it done. The DNC is not telling them how to get it done. They're talking to different vendors who run these different systems.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the different systems? Well, the different systems, if you have any kind of remote voting, is what is your interface? Where is your ballot? It's either going to be like using a telephone, like I'm talking on now, to punch buttons in to choose a candidate, or using an app, or using some kind of web page. Well, Iowa decided that they want to use a telephone interface, and because they're concerned about all the issues surrounding online voting.
That's
well,
good.
The thing about it is, a telephone interface still ends up becoming an online system if you get into the back end, because the data has to travel.
Right.
But the biggest thing is, when I spoke to people, is, and these are people who have studied telephone-based systems in Canada and other places, is older people have a really hard time punching in all the numbers and hearing. And when you have 23 or 24 candidates, I'm forgetting now, the number seems to be changing,
right,
and you have to rank them the top 5 in a row, it's not going to be the friendliest process. Now, this is what the feedback that I've gotten from people, and I've written articles to try to highlight what the DNC might ask about, because the vendors are going to come in and they're going to say, no problem, we've got you covered. And then, as Bob Mulholland, the former California State Democratic Party director, told me just a couple weeks ago, if things go wrong, then the state parties will blame the vendors. So it becomes this perfect circle where the process itself might get discredited. The thing about this is, in other states, like Nevada, they won't tell me who their vendors are, although I've talked to people who have been lobbying the state and helping them draw up their plans. And, they may have a much more complicated system than in Iowa, because they're going to get everybody who's voting remotely to have their votes be allocated to all of those hundreds of precincts. And so the thing about all this is, you don't introduce a new voting system where you don't have a trial run. There
right.
is no trial run for these caucuses. It's not as if, you know, they're one-time events. And so, you know, we could talk about all the, you know, cybersecurity issues and the hacking pathways and everything like that. But from a human behavior standpoint, there's going to be a lot of confusion because people are unfamiliar with what's supposed to go on.
Even if they were familiar, the point that you make is right on the money, I think. The fact that this has never been actual, that this will not have ever been tested in an actual election or caucus of any type until we're looking at the all-important, early caucuses in Iowa and Nevada. Which, you know, some may play down the importance of caucuses, but in these early states like Iowa and Nevada, they really do play a very key role traditionally in sort of thinning the herd right off the bat and highlighting potential front runners, etc. These are huge, high stakes. And your article makes it clear, once again, that it seems to me the state parties are not really ready for what is coming. You mentioned the Iowa case where they're talking about using a phone. I don't even know. You know, it's one thing if you've got three or four choices to choose from, hit three for Cory Booker. But how do you hit, 17 for Elizabeth Warren or whatever it happens to be? It seems like we're heading into a nightmare. So I want to, in the just minute or two that I have here left, what is the process? When do final decisions need to be made on all of this?
What happens is this. The DNC has a rules committee,
mm-hmm.
and they meet monthly, and they will be meeting next Friday
mm-hmm.
in Pittsburgh to basically start going over the specifics from the Iowa and then Nevada
mm-hmm.
to see whether or not they can approve these plans.
And
what's happened is, I've written probably more articles than anyone else pointing out where things have gotten complicated. I'm not writing stuff to trash the DNC or anybody. I'm just, I want elections to work.
But
they don't necessarily know enough of the questions to ask.
Does Iowa or Nevada, have they finalized their plans yet in either of those two states?
Well, they say they have, I don't know, Brad, because here's the thing. Every time I see deadlines on paper and I call to find out, the deadlines are broken.
And once they do come up with something that we will pretend to be final plans in either of those states, do they then have to get approval from the DNC? And can the DNC then say, no, this is not sufficient, go find another plan?
That's what Jim Roosevelt alluded to.
Okay.
And that's the thing that I asked him twice, because I said, I just think to myself, what? Because, I'm telling him about the most prevalent concerns that I'm hearing, and they're about usability issues. They're not about hacking. And he's telling me, well, those are real issues, but the thing is, we've got bigger concerns. And I'm saying, are you saying that, the question...
What are the bigger concerns?
Well, he was alluding to that, integrity of the process.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Well, it can mean a lot of things. But when I said to him, so are you saying that you might backtrack here or, reverse course? That's where that quote at the top of the article comes from, where he said yes.
Good. That's good news, isn't it, Steve?
Well, we don't know if it's good news, Brad, because the truth of the matter is you're going to get vendors coming in with very slick sales pitches, and you're going to have state party executive directors, and I know some of these people, they're not bad people, they're good people, but they, this is not their expertise.
No.
They're going to be nodding, and they're going to be saying, okay, it's a go, let's try it. And you get this groupthink going on, and you don't know how it's going
to
go.
No, you don't. And this is madness, and that's why I wanted to have you on to have an update on this after we talked about the madness a few months ago. And now we have this good news that maybe they're pulling back. I mean, if one of these contests, Steve, is marred by Democratic voters believing they have been screwed.
How can that not be the case, Brad, when you have only one winner or two winners and you have 20 others who feel that they should have won?
Yeah.
has nothing to do with the facts. It has to do with all you have to do. I mean, I have people, this guy who I quoted from Canada, he says, we see this right now,
yep.
where people are saying, the official results are announced, and they're saying, we don't believe the official results.
Yep.
And then they're going on to social media, and then this is the craziness.
This is why you need a transparent process so that people can't do that. This is why I complain about ballot marking devices, these computers that print ballots that after the election we can never know if they actually reflect the intent of the voters. Whether they do or not, whether they're 100% secure, it doesn't matter if you can have people questioning the process. That in and of itself is a threat to democracy. And the Democrats seem to be playing with fire, walking straight into this mess. And I hope that cooler heads prevail. I hope that that Roosevelt fella you mentioned, I hope that he looks at these systems. Is there anyone at the DNC actually recommending against these systems, saying these things that you're saying, Steve Rosenfeld, saying, no, these are bad ideas, let's not do this?
Well, you know, I'm not exactly getting a lot of calls returned these days because I'm viewed as being a bit of a Cassandra. You know, like maybe I know a little too much about stuff. And I'm not writing these articles to set them up to fail. I'm writing these articles so that they can make the right decision because I recognize the stakes are so high.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's one thing if, you know, Bernie loses and his people, you know, go online and make all this noise on Reddit and all these other places and everything like that. It's another thing if institutionally, you know, in the first and the third contest, the Democrats have a complete mess, and then
yep.
Trump runs with it, you know, and yells and screams about stolen elections all the way into the fall. But, you know, the whole thing is just, you know, it's madness on top of madness. And like, do you want to take stuff off the table or leave it on the table?
Yeah, and by the way, that madness is going to be followed up, I fear, in the fifth week when Super Tuesday happens and states like California and Los Angeles County with a 100% unverifiable brand new computer touchscreen system is going to hold their elections with about a dozen other states just 3 days after the South Carolina primary. Steve, very quickly, what can our listeners, is there anything that our listeners can do to push the DNC to not use phone and internet voting schemes in these caucuses coming up?
I don't know. I mean, people who are part of active in the California Party, where, you know, they have a technology caucus. They were talking about it at the state convention a couple weeks ago, and that's filtered through. So, you know, people are, the word has really come. You know, it's filtering through. Now the question is, you know, can they just, you know, slow this down? My suspicion is they may try to put some brakes on this, at least in Iowa and Nevada. It matters less, I dare say, if Alaska uses this.
Right.
Something like this.
Well,
I'm sorry, Alaskans, but
yeah, I know. Well, maybe not. It may not matter less to those voters, but I take your point. And by the way, this is a party, the Democratic Party, which now has, you know, they passed HR1 in the House, which mandates a hand marked paper ballot for every vote.
There's supposed to be audit trails here. That's another thing here. That, you know, the thing about this is what you have is the DNC rules, their goals, they're not how you get it done.
Yeah, as you know,
it's wonderful to say, hey, we're going to have an audit trail, and we're going to have, we got to have like results released, you know, in these contests. But the real question is how.
And you know that the devil is in the details when you use the word audit trail. They're not really auditable in many cases. Steve, I got to get out. Please stay in touch as this unnecessary nightmare in the making moves forward. I know almost everybody else, certainly in the corporate media, they're focused on the horse race as usual. They're not, they'll get around maybe to covering these issues at the last second once it's too late for them to be undone or for anybody to do anything about it. So please, thank you for staying on this. Please keep us updated as all of this moves forward. And thanks for your excellent, detailed, and early reporting on all of this, Steve Rosenfeld.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You can find Steve Rosenfeld's work. We will link, of course, to his latest story. You can also find it at the independentmediainstitute.org, and you can follow him online on the Twitters at SRose14. Mr. Rosenfeld, thanks again, my friend.
Okay, Brad, thank you.
You bet. Okay, quick break, and we are back with Desi Doyen and the latest Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Desi Doyen.
Hey.
This is our one and only Green News Report for this week.
Yes.
Because no Green News Report on Thursday because we're wrestling with all of the debate, Democratic debate fun.
Yeah, blame fun, the Democratic we'll National fun. Committee because yes. of the debate fun.
So they won't have a Democratic debate on climate change, plus they've completely ruined our second Green News Report of the week.
Exactly.
Isn't that just like the Democrats? All right, well, let's get to it then. Our latest and one and only Green News Report.
Do you think it's a threat? Man-made climate emergency is a threat.
I think the answer to that is going to be based upon the science.
Well, the science says yes.
Vice President Mike Pence refuses to acknowledge his own administration, says climate change is a threat to national security.
Every well is drying up, every reservoir, and now the death toll is at 126 because of the heat.
Millions suffering from water shortages and heat waves in India. Trump USDA burying studies on the impacts of climate change on U.S. agriculture, plus General Electric scraps natural gas power plant 20 years early.
Why?
You'll find out.
All of those mysteries and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You know, the truth of the matter is with the advent of natural gas, with the natural gas explosion that's developing, with clean coal technology, We're seeing a significant reduction in carbon emissions all across this country.
A, no, we're not. And B, with the natural gas explosion that's developing? Really, Mike Pence? Those are the best words you got. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, you're really going to make me wait 6 minutes to hear why General Electric is closing down that nat gas plant?
Yes, I am.
Damn it.
But first, as we go to air, the first 2020 Democratic presidential primary debates are about to launch in Miami, Florida, and we'll be watching to see if climate change is a big topic. And it better be, since the Democratic National Committee refused to hold a debate specifically focused on climate change. And as if right on cue, on Monday, Miami broke a new daily heat record and a large wildfire erupted in the Florida Everglades, which officials say will continue to burn amid the scorching heat until some rain arrives.
Oh, well, that's great. Good thing the Democrats are not having a debate on our climate emergency. Why would they possibly want to do that?
In India, the city of Chennai, home to nearly 6 million people, has become the first major Indian city to face acute water shortages. Water levels in all of the city's reservoirs have fallen to their lowest levels in 70 years due to weak monsoon rains, a prolonged severe heat wave, and lack of water infrastructure. Scientists say India has seen a drop in overall average rainfall since 1970, and its groundwater is being rapidly depleted. Without improved water management, 21 Indian cities are projected to run out of groundwater within the next few years, and 40% of India could run out of groundwater by 2030.
Well, that's not going to cause a problem at all for the entire world.
Europe is grappling with an extended extreme heat wave, predicted to be so severe that officials are taking emergency measures to protect vulnerable populations like the elderly and the poor, particularly in old world cities where few buildings have air conditioning.
What climate change?
The annual Arctic spring thaw has begun with a vengeance. Arctic scientists say soaring temperatures 40 degrees above normal have triggered the earliest melt of the surface of the Greenland ice sheet ever recorded in the month of June. Arctic sea ice has also reached a record early low for the month of June. But here in the U.S., Politico reports that the Trump Department of Agriculture is burying dozens of federally funded scientific studies that inform American farmers about the effects of man-made climate change, which is already altering the U.S. agriculture economy and our ability to grow staple food crops.
Well, it's best they keep that stuff a secret.
The U.S. just experienced its wettest 12 months on record, and farmers in the Midwest are struggling to get their corn and soy crops in the ground on time. Pretending climate change doesn't exist does not make it go away.
Says you.
But Trump's Vice President Mike Pence, in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, refused to even say if he agrees with U.S. scientists and the U.S. military that climate change is a threat to national security. And instead, he lied about the impacts of rolling back pollution regulations.
So you don't think it's a threat, is all I'm saying. You don't think it's a threat.
I think we're making great progress reducing carbon emissions. America has the cleanest air and water in the world. We'll continue to use market forces.
We don't have the cleanest air and water in the world. You get back to me with some statistics.
But we're making progress on reducing carbon emissions.
I love the fact that Jake Tapper is just openly laughing at the vice president.
Yeah, and of course, what Pence said is just not true. Since the start of the Trump administration, both U.S. carbon emissions and toxic air pollution are on the rise. And finally...
Is this that GE story?
Yes, it is.
Finally.
General Electric has announced it will close and demolish a 10-year-old natural gas-fired power plant in California that still has 20 years remaining in its useful life because the plant is, quote, uneconomical due to market competition from cheaper, cleaner solar and wind energy.
Really?
Really.
Perhaps GE ought to talk to Vice President Mike Pence about that developing natural gas explosion he was referencing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey.
Another one bites the dust. But in this case, we often play that song for coal plants that are shutting down.
Yes.
This is actually a natural gas plant shutting down 20 years early. So
exactly.
This is really the first one to bite the dust, isn't it?
Just yes,
about?
It is.
All right. Well,
fossil fuels are on the way out.
Now you tell me. I just bought 5 new ICE cars, internal combustion engine cars.
No, you didn't. But okay.
No, I didn't. Still the same old Prius from decades old. All right, that's it. We got to get out of here. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast site. Though we do thank those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. As you are the only ones who help Desi and I stay on your public airwaves and fill up our Prius tank. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. And that is it. Until we meet again tomorrow, and I can't wait, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. Ow! Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey! Another one bites the dust. Hey!